Hi, this is Faith Mitchell, President of Grantmakers in Health. I'd like to welcome you to the latest edition in GIH's podcast series. Our goal is to provide you with an insider's view of what's happening on the front lines of health by hearing from leaders in the field. I hope you enjoy these podcasts and find them insightful as you lead your philanthropic work.
On behalf of the board of Grantmakers in Health, its President and CEO Faith Mitchell, and the staff, I'd like to welcome you to the fourth annual Lauren Leroy Health Policy Lecture. I'm Dr. Jandel Allen Davis. I'm the Vice President of Government External Relations and Research at Kaiser Permanente in Colorado, and have the wonderful honor of chairing an awesome board here and working alongside an amazing group of folks. So Grantmakers in Health established the Lauren Leroy Health Policy Lecture Series in honor of its former president and CEO, Lauren Leroy, and her commitment to increasing communication between the worlds of philanthropy and policy. The series is supported by grants from the Blue Shield of California Foundation, the California Endowment, the California Healthcare Foundation, California Wellness Foundation, the Colorado Health Foundation, oh good, there we are, Kaiser Permanente, the Missouri Foundation for Health, the New York State Health Foundation, and the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. So let's acknowledge them very briefly, too, for all of the really tremendous gratitude for this sort of support in these series. So today's lecture features Kathy Ko Chin, President and Chief Executive Officer of the Asian and Pacific Islander American Health Forum, a national health justice organization which influences policy, mobilizes communities, and strengthens programs and organizations to improve the health of Asian Americans. The work described in her bio, and it's there at our tables, and evidences her longstanding professional commitment to nonprofit community organizations for more than 30 years. And this work has been conducted in various forms, including as staff, as a consultant, and in governance role to nonprofits and foundations in areas such as program development, strategic planning and positioning, and capital facilities development. I had the chance to sit next to a fellow board member, David Fukuzawa, who said that Kathy Ko Chin is awesome. So with that, please join me in welcoming her to the podium.
Thank you so much. Well, David Fukuzawa is awesome, too. Good afternoon. It's really wonderful to be here with you all. I want to just open by first thanking Faith and Asua and the GIH team for this incredible honor and tell you a little secret, which is doing this lecture is very special to me because Lauren Leroy was my very first boss. Faith will get me for this, for aging us, but almost 40 years ago. Faith was a postdoc at UCSF. Lauren Leroy was a PhD candidate. I was a squirt of an intern. We all worked together at the UCSF Institute for Health Policy Studies, which is now named for the dear Phil Lee. And so that was actually the beginning of my health and health policy career. So this is a very special moment for me to be able to do it in honor of Lauren Leroy. And so I want to thank Faith and Osula and the GIH team for that. Over 100 years ago, in the middle of San Francisco Bay, stood Angel Island. It wasn't Alcatraz, but it was still a prison for anyone who passed through. And their crime was wanting to become an American, but being unwanted by the United States. It was where Chinese and other immigrants seeking a life in the New World were imprisoned and interrogated before they were allowed into the U.S. or sent back to their home countries. It was also where Chinese captured from all across the country were sent before their imminent deportation. The immigration station stood as a literal barrier between their dream of becoming an American and the harsh realities of being an unwanted immigrant. In fact, the soft redwood walls of the immigration station are carved, just as in this photo, with hundreds of Chinese poems that are the primary documentation of the immigrant experience and of the imprisonment of thousands of immigrants who waited for the U.S. government to determine their fate. I come to you today as a child of immigrants who taught me at a very early age that I would be treated differently than all the other children, that I would have to do better just to be treated equally. My parents, immigrants from China, taught me this lesson the night before I went to kindergarten. Imagine being 5 years old and being told that. The model minority is a myth, and it begins in a harsh and discriminating environment. Imagine how you would feel, like those who entered through Angel Island Immigration Station, the moment you step foot in this country. You were separated from your family, imprisoned for weeks or months, stripped for group medical examinations, and interrogated to see if you were worthy of entering this country, to see whether you were deserving enough to enter. These are the attitudes that have undergirded our immigration policies, as well as access to a whole range of health and human services for more than a century, and these attitudes are still with us today. There's something else that's being talked about being built, right? For the 21 million and rising Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders who call the U.S. home, I come to you today to just give you a glimpse of the immigrant character of our communities and the impact that that has on our ability to live a healthy life. I'm honored to be the president and CEO of the Asian and Pacific Islander American Health Forum, which we refer to more simply as the Health Forum. I want to acknowledge that we have a number of our board members from our national board and our DC staff here. So if people could just like wave, just so we can thank you all for your service. I'm so privileged to have such incredible colleagues to work with all over the country. For 30 years, the Health Forum has been the clear, strong voice in the nation's capital for Asian American, Native Hawaiian, and Pacific Islander health. We have worked to create a shared path towards health equity, and we bridge communities from all across the country and across the Pacific to the administration, Congress, and the Supreme Court. We have strong partnerships with community-based organizations in 27 states and rising and counting, and 100 organizations. We listen deeply to our communities and use our position to advance their needs in the areas of health policy at the federal level. We know that the path towards health equity is intertwined with the fates of many other communities. And so we're honored to also work with our African American, Latino, and Native American communities, especially through the Kellogg Foundation Racial Equity Initiative. Now let me turn to the topic of today's lecture, which is immigration and health. As a population that is two-thirds immigrant, immigration status affects every aspect of life for Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders. But most of all, it determines how deserving the U.S. feels you are to first enter this country and then to access the services once you're here. One thing is clear. It is exclusionary. Our system is exclusionary and leaves millions without resources, help, or access to the care that they need based on immigration status, including those who are legally here. The intersection between health and immigration isn't always immediately obvious, but it is crucial if we're trying to work towards health equity. And the first step is to think about access for all. Today, I want to talk to you about how immigration status, now more than ever, has become the single determinant of whether or not you have health coverage in this country. I also want to go over how being an immigrant determines whether or not you have meaningful access to care. So let's first examine who immigrants are in our country and what it means to be an immigrant. In the political and social discourse of the last 20 years, immigrant has actually come to mean Latino. But 50 years from now, immigrants from Asian countries, as you can see in this chart, will make up the largest percentage of the foreign-born in our country for the first time. And policies must take into account not just the healthcare needs of immigrants, but the importance of cultural competency and language access, and how these needs are influenced by the individual countries of origin and specific cultures. We must also think about where immigrants are in the United States. Certainly, every state in the country has immigrants, but we also know that they concentrate in certain states. And their experiences are informed not only by federal policy, but state policy as well, such as California and New York, that have expanded health care to most immigrant groups. And like migration patterns, where immigrants live in the United States is changing. As immigrant populations grow, we see immigrant communities thrive outside of the regions that are traditionally considered immigrant hubs, especially in the South and Midwest. Last year, Georgia, Massachusetts, Virginia, and Washington State crossed the 1 million mark for foreign-born populations. Census data shows that Arizona, Maryland, and Pennsylvania will likely cross this marker, too, in the next decade. When we look at the top metropolitan areas in the U.S. with the highest immigrant populations, the data shows cities that you would expect, New York, Los Angeles, Miami, Houston, San Francisco, Chicago. However, when you look at cities outside the top 10, but still in the top 25, there are growing immigrant populations in cities that you might not initially expect, places like Atlanta, Las Vegas, Orlando, and the Twin Cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul. With areas on this green map showing where there is 17 to 43% increases in the foreign-born population, which is the darkest green areas, more and more states, in addition to many metropolitan areas already, will be faced with language access needs and a growing diversity in the populations that are served by the healthcare system. More specifically, for Asian American, Native Hawaiian, and Pacific Islander populations, according to the census, our population is the fastest growing racial or ethnic population in the country. The 2015 American Community Survey data reports that Asian Americans stand over 20 million people, and Native Hawaiians and Pacific Islanders stand at more than 1.3 million, comprising over 6% of the total population. And these populations are expected to double by the year 2060. Yet these statistical classifications do not provide a full view of the diversity and varied life experiences our communities have. Among Asian Americans, Native Hawaiians, and Pacific Islanders, there are over 100 different languages, and people come from 50 different countries. Asian Americans alone are mostly immigrants, with almost 60% of the population being foreign-born, regardless of immigration status. And half of the Asian American population lives in four states, California, New York, Texas, and New Jersey. And half of the Native Hawaiian and Pacific Islander population lives in three states of Hawaii, California, and Washington State. Perhaps surprisingly, the top 10 states with the highest Asian American, Native Hawaiian, and Pacific Islander populations include Pennsylvania and Florida. Not what you would expect, not what I expected. And in the last 10 years, both states have seen tremendous growth of Asian American, Native Hawaiian, and Pacific Islander populations. And as we have seen in places even this week, such as Utah, Nevada, New Jersey, and Virginia, Asian American and Native Hawaiian Pacific Islander communities have grown at rapid rates and are amassing political power, enough to be, as Representative Judy Chu, the chair of the Congressional Asian Pacific American Caucus, often says, the margin of victory. So turning back to immigration and immigrant inclusion policies, just like on Angel Island, our country continues to ask the question of who deserves to be an American. And federal policy today tells us that immigrants are not deserving of health care and that some are perceived to be even less deserving than others. In public health, we've come to recognize social determinants of health, such as transportation, education, access to resources, jobs, as well as residential segregation. And I, as I said earlier, have come to argue ever since even the ACA that immigration status now is the single greatest social determinant of whether or not you are covered in this country. So let's look at a list of different immigration statuses to see what their eligibility for coverage is. This is just a sampling of all the different immigration statuses that are available. And in each of these cases, they are treated differently in terms of coverage. This slide just gives you 3 points of the varying determination of eligibility. And then for children, there's the added barrier that even if they do qualify for coverage, their undocumented parents have barriers to enrolling them. And let me give you some examples of how this plays out. One of our community-based organization partners in New York serves not only the Asian American immigrant population, but also other low-income immigrant populations. Their stories are heartbreaking, but show the potential for policy changes that could support immigrant health. An undocumented Arab American family from Staten Island has a child who's losing her eyesight. They didn't have any insurance and came into the office for answers. They trusted our partner organization to start an application for their daughter. Documents were submitted for ID proofing, and within 2 days, this is New York, the application was processed. The child is now on New York's child health plan, which accepts her eye doctors as part of their plan, and now she's scheduled for surgery. These parents are so happy, and they're really relieved that their child's eyesight can be spared, providing them with peace of mind. In another example, there's a Korean-American mom living in New York, struggling to support her family, but living in the shadows of being undocumented. She fears interacting with anyone who seems official. But only through a community-based organization in the Korean American community did she realize that despite being undocumented, she could enroll her citizen child into the coverage the child was legally entitled to. But for other undocumented parents, without anywhere to turn, this chilling anti-immigrant environment we live in now, for them, there's a palpable fear about enrolling their eligible children, and this is a real barrier. Fortunately, there are trusted community partners all across the country, like ours in New York, where immigrants can get covered. So, as we look over the past 20 years, policies on access to coverage and improving immigrant health have actually gotten worse. And this has happened both in Democratic and Republican administrations. Access to coverage and to health and human services for immigrants has consistently declined because of intentional federal policy. Prior to welfare reform in 1996, immigrants did not face any restrictions on access to Medicaid, and they had the same eligibility as everyone else. But welfare reform substantially cut who was eligible and created arbitrary classifications of qualified and non-qualified status, which actually now are terms of art in legislation. Then, on one hand, the ACA offered a glimmer of hope for communities. Under the ACA, all lawfully present immigrants, also now a term of art, would be eligible, assuming they met income requirements, for either tax credits or cost-sharing subsidies. This was a significant expansion in coverage for immigrant populations for everyone legally residing in the U.S. However, at the same time, the ACA maintained other restrictions, locking out undocumented immigrants completely from purchasing in the marketplace, even if they wanted to with their own funds, as we always said, like going to the grocery store to buy a gallon of milk and being asked for your immigration status. And the previous administration arbitrarily removed eligibility for DACA recipients, essentially throwing them back into the undocumented status for health coverage, adding to a confusing patchwork of eligibility by immigration status. And then, of course, this year has brought a fresh wave of attacks on immigrant communities in many different ways. We have seen various repeal efforts seeking to further restrict coverage for the same immigrants who pay into the system, just like everyone else does, through their taxes. With no relief in sight, this 20-year trend of continued restrictions on healthcare for immigrants is ill-advised, especially as a population is expected to nearly double of all foreign-born Americans by the year 2065, when one in three Americans will be an immigrant or have an immigrant parent. This is no way to assure access, and this is no way to run a healthcare system that is good for all Americans. This will go beyond access challenges and will have even deeper effects on cost and quality. So now, looking beyond coverage, immigrants with coverage continue to face barriers to health equity, in particular language access. Nearly half of all immigrants are limited English proficient, or LEP. As research has found, including by the National Academy of Medicine, LEP people experience a number of disparities that make them vulnerable to poor health outcomes. In the clinical setting, studies have shown that patients who are LEP and who receive interpretation services have much better outcomes than those who do not. Federal laws, including Section 1557 of the ACA, ensure that any healthcare facility or entity receiving any federal funding or a federal agency cannot discriminate on the basis of national origin, which includes primary language. As immigrants shape the face of our country, we need to make sure our healthcare system matches their needs. Insurance companies, hospitals, and health systems must be able to ensure language access while balancing the administrative and cost factors of this work. In another area, in order to reveal disparities and address health equity, we also need the data to point the way. While we can speak to the impact of disparities on immigrant populations, we often lack the specific data needed in order to address these disparities. Identifying the healthcare needs of immigrant communities requires better data, disaggregated by race and ethnic group and by geographic level. It's an obvious point, but a point worth repeating. If we don't have the data to tell the story, We won't know what the issues really are, who is impacted, or how best to tailor resources. As the saying goes, what gets counted gets addressed. Let me give you one example of how important disaggregated data has been. When Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders are aggregated into one big group, before the coverage expansions of the ACA in 2013, as one big lumped group, Asian Pacific Islanders had the highest rates of coverage, the lowest rates of uninsurance. But when disaggregated, as you can see in this slide, in fact, Korean Americans had the highest rates of uninsurance in the entire country at 23%, followed very closely by Bangladeshis, 24%, and Pakistanis at 23%. And then our staff went further to look at more disaggregated data and found the direct correlation in these same ethnic communities between uninsurance and small business ownership and employment. So armed with this disaggregated data, we were able to design our outreach education enrollment campaign to be in language to those communities of highest uninsurance and targeting small business owners. In the previous four rounds of open enrollment, 2 million Asian American Pacific Islanders were enrolled. And using our targeted strategy, our national network that's shown here called Action for Health Justice assisted 1 million of these 2 million people. As you can see from our map, our network stretched across 23 states, and that is continuing to grow, and the enrollment assistance was in 56 languages. We are very clear that had it not been for, one, the disaggregated data so that we could target our work, but primarily for our dedicated, trusted community partners on the ground, those 1 million people would not have gotten enrolled. This resulted in the largest drop in uninsurance in any ethnic population in the country by 50%, resulting in the highest rates of coverage. Thank you. Thank you. I am very, very proud of this work, and we're in it again in open enrollment round 5, all 6 weeks of it. I want to acknowledge that our efforts to build Action for Health Justice and to assist those 1 million people and counting was completely dependent on private philanthropy, as no federal funds were allocated specifically to our communities to do this work. The leadership of the Wallace H. Coulter Foundation, joined by the Kresge Foundation and the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, allowed us to do this important work. Your work really does make a difference in people's lives. And as people discussed this morning in the opening session, this is a prime example of how private philanthropy funding can really help consumer assistance and make a difference. Now, turning to language access for the enrolled, last year, the Department of Health and Human Services Office of Civil Rights issued regulations specifying how providers, health insurance companies, and other covered entities can comply with Section 1557, which are the civil rights provisions of the ACA. This includes posting of patients' rights to an interpreter on in-language posters in doctors' offices and inclusion of in-language taglines on significant documents from insurance companies. We've been working closely with the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services to help them improve language access in their programs, particularly around ACA enrollment. We've succeeded in increasing the amount of materials in language, including most recently an in-language companion to the eligibility determination notice. And our national network also provided standardized glossaries in 13 different languages to the CMS-contracted call centers so that there could be standardized communication in those languages around enrolling in the federal marketplaces. More broadly, the movement to address quality in healthcare and the move to value-based care offers an opportunity to strategically ensure that health equity and language access for immigrant communities are part of the equation. As I said earlier, we know that what gets measured gets done, and if we can align incentives along the way, communities of color can benefit from access to care. We all, from advocates like ourselves at the Health Forum to other national partners, including local community partners and funders, we all play a role in making sure that everyone, including people of all immigration statuses, are able to live healthy lives. Whether it is research to understand immigrant health needs, communications to shape the narrative and counter the presumption of who is deserving or not, or directly influencing those who make decisions about the allocation of healthcare resources, we believe it is critical to provide access to healthcare to all, including all immigrants of any immigration status. So, since this is Grant Makers in Health, let me outline some things that you as funders can think about. Funders and all of us who set or influence policy in public or private spheres need to listen to all communities. Communities know best what solutions will most directly address their needs. How can we shift the power and control from funders to communities for community-driven solutions? As I said earlier, we need data to better identify disparities as well as to identify the approaches that are most effective to address disparities. By building the evidence base on what immigrant health needs look like, we can advance improvements to immigrant coverage and care. Data, including data on public opinion, is key to creating the necessary narratives and messaging to shape policy. For example, we find that just talking about disparities is not enough, but really making the business case and really trying to make an economic argument will really shape how policymakers think about our issues. So how we can compile data, evidence, and the stories to really influence policy also needs support. For example, we need to know how language access affects access and utilization, how language access barriers affect cost and quality. What is the linkage between cost, quality, and immigrant social determinants of health? We don't know those answers as a country. We also need to quantify the impact of the new anti-immigrant policies that have been cropping up this year. What has the impact been on healthcare utilization? And how has that affected people's attitudes about accessing care and utilizing the insurance that they might be covered for? The future of health policy overall for our country lies in reducing healthcare costs while improving quality through the healthcare delivery system. These changes tied to payment reform and improving health IT or increasing the role of community health workers are moving quietly but quickly. And in order to assure health equity, we need the analysis on the impact of immigrants. And immigrant voices must be at the table. There's also deep value in funding demonstrations around these issues. What does delivery system reform look like when the remaining uninsured, like immigrants, are included or excluded? What models effectively tie social determinants of health to new measurement systems and standards, such as continuing HEDIS measures and MACRA? Do current delivery system reform models work for immigrants in order to resolve language access barriers or to implement class standards, cultural and linguistic access standards? And we all need to engage in advocacy at all levels of government. The federal government is the primary setter of both immigration policy as well as access to care policies. And we have seen recent actions like ending DACA eligibility and greater immigrant restrictions in the various bills to repeal and replace the ACA. At the state level, we've seen both anti- and pro-immigrant legislation at state levels. We need to highlight the positive steps that some states have taken to improve immigrant health care and encouraging other states to follow their lead while fighting back against the anti-immigrant ones that are restricting immigrants' rights to living healthy lives. On the very local level, we believe that funders should actively engage with community-based organizations. CBOs can provide better interpretation services and translated materials than large systems because they have deep cultural knowledge and understanding. However, they're not adequately funded to provide these services, which can leave a number of LEP individuals without access to care. Think of the two examples I had earlier, and had there not been trusted community partners, they would not have been able to access the care that they were eligible for. So this morning, as Karen Politz mentioned, how to really assure that consumer assistance is part of the system on a permanent level, part of that is really helping to support the capacity and infrastructure of trusted community partners. So in closing, we have a clear path forward as a nation if we intend to create a truly equitable society with equal opportunity and a healthy future for all. Being an immigrant or having immigrant family members should not prevent you from accessing the care you need or to be part of a strong and healthy society. As funders, you can take meaningful steps towards health equity in your work, as I've just outlined. And I encourage you to not only do advocacy work yourself, but to also support advocacy work by your grantees. It is a true testament to the American dream for more than two centuries and for millions of Americans that it is possible to create a better life in the United States. Here are my parents. And I am so grateful to them, my immigrant parents, for embarking upon a journey nearly 60 years ago, as my father often reminds me, with only $36 in his pocket, that has resulted in creating a wonderful life, the American dream, for their four children and their six grandchildren. I wish for that, the American dream, for all Americans who live in these wonderful United States of America. Thank you very much, and I look forward to your questions.
We hope you enjoyed listening to this podcast. For more information about Grantmakers in Health, visit us online at gih.org.